I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World with Colonel Jeff McCausland, United States Army, Dickinson College, CEO of Diamond Six Leadership and Strategy, my guide on the Battle of Gettysburg. It is now July 2nd, 1863. The Union Army has arrived and formed a fish hook around Cemetery Hill. This is Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, rolling hills, quite beautiful, still is today. You're all welcome to the park. We're now reviewing what we know about the decisions made by the commanders on the second day of Gettysburg. Jeff, Lee's mission, I've read over the years, was to win the war, not to win a battle. What was Longstreet's mission that day, the second day?
I think Longstreet's mission was to support that, but Lee was thinking strategically, as you suggest, John, to win the war. We may be winning battles, but Lee, I think, fully understood they couldn't sustain the effort indefinitely, and the Yankees perhaps could. Longstreet was more operational, let's win the battle, and they actually get into a bit of an argument on the afternoon of June 30th as the fighting is coming to a close, when Longstreet argues that they should maneuver south, pick out some terrain, and let the Yankees attack them. And Lee famously says, but if those people are there in the morning, we will attack them at that place. And Longstreet retorts, if those people are there, General Lee, in the morning, it is because they want you to attack them at that place.
The Union forms a fish hook from Culp's Hill, around Cemetery Hill, down to Little Round Top and Round Top, along the Tenneytown Road. What we're looking at is a good defensive position for Meade and his corps commanders. Lee means to break it, and he has possibility of drawing off the Union Army's strength by simultaneously attacking from two or three directions. Jeff, what is an interior line? Why does that favor Meade?
The interior line is a shorter distance, so the fact that the Union line running from Culp's Hill, Cemetery Hill, down the Round Top is only a few miles means that Meade can more quickly reposition forces, whereas Lee line goes all the way around the outside of that fish hook, and as a consequence, his line is about twice as long. So to reposition forces to reinforce if there's a counterattack or to reinforce if there's success is much more difficult for Lee. So Meade enjoys the advantage of interior lines and throughout the battle will reposition forces, plug in holes, in an effort to counter the offensive of the Confederates, and frankly, over the 3 days, does a pretty good job at that.
We're going to concentrate on the left flank of the Union line because a mistake is made by General Sickles. The mistake is that he pushes out and leaves a gap between Hancock's line and Sickles's line in a place called the Peach Orchard. Why is that gap critical, Jeff? What does it mean for the Union weakness?
Well, it's critical because, of course, there's a gap between the unit to his north and Sickles to his south, and Sickles is the southernmost corps along that fish hook down to the Round Tops. As a consequence, A.P. Hill, who's attacking at the center to fix Union forces at that place, had the possibility of penetrating right there and busting the line. Secondarily, by moving forward to the Peach Orchard, he not only disconnects the line, he, Sickles, from the force to his north, but he creates a bulge in the line. So he can actually be hit from three sides simultaneously as Peter Longstreet begins his advance, which initially had been to encircle the left flank, but comes in at much more of a head-on attack. Now, all of this occurs in part because though Longstreet was directed by Lee at 8 o'clock in the morning to move his force down for that attack and expected the attack to occur about noon, Longstreet doesn't move as he's waiting for some of his units to arrive. He doesn't move until early afternoon. Has to do a countermarch, so the attack that Lee expected in the south to begin around noon doesn't begin till 4 or even 4:30 in the afternoon. And more Union forces have arrived and lengthened that line along Cemetery Ridge.
Sickles' mistake, however, will compound the difficulties in this, the second day. My memory, Jeff, is the Peach Orchard's famous, the wheat field is famous, Devil's Den is famous. It's a slaughter fest going on. We're looking at the Union firing down, but at the same time, Sickles' forces have been fragmented by extending their line. Longstreet has the ability to capitalize on this. And then we come to Hancock. Hancock arrives seeing the hole and doesn't have any men left. I've always marveled at this moment in the battle. First Minnesota, what does Hancock order them to do? What do they do to hold the line, Jeff?
Hancock realizes there's a Confederate brigade advancing there towards the center of the Union line where that gap exists. The only unit there is the 1st Minnesota, a regiment, probably only 350 soldiers by that time in the war. And there's a brigade that's three or four times its size, Confederates advancing. Hancock will ride up to the commander of the 1st Minnesota, and he'll say, "Colonel, do you see that brigade's colors?" The colonel will say, "Yes, sir, I do." Hancock says, "Take those colors." And the 1st Minnesota will then do a bayonet attack against a brigade that's three or four times its size. They will take 80% casualties in that one particular unit from Minnesota, but they will halt that attack until more forces back to interior lines, more Union forces can be plugged. The hole is filled. The Union line holds.
It is a fair question. Why would the brigade not recognize they completely outnumbered the regiment? The needed understanding is the terrain and black powder, gun smoke. Jeff, what does the battlefield look like to any particular person, any commander on it? Can they see?
Ground between Seminary Ridge and Cemetery Ridge, which is what the Confederates are traversing, undulates a bit, and so there are dips along the way. By this time, there's been an awful lot of fighting going on throughout the afternoon the second day. It's warm. There's not a great deal of breeze. And so there's probably a great deal of smoke that is obscuring any type of observation for movement, even at close distances. That certainly is part and parcel of it. The second reason, though, John, I think that that brigade is Confederates fails to exploit the advantages they clearly have. It's just a matter of surprise. They see this Yankee unit of some size advancing very rapidly upon them with their bayonets fixed, and the sudden reaction is we must be being attacked by a force that is at least equal to or greater than our numbers. I mean, who would do an attack otherwise? I think that element of surprise, along with smoke, along with the terrain, contributes to the success of the 1st Minnesota in thwarting the possibility of the Confederates splitting the Union line.
In the storytelling after the battle, Chamberlain commanding a main infantry unit on the left flank at Little Round Top is often mentioned as saving the battle. That may or may not be true. It's worth noting, however, that Longstreet continued to try to flank the Union line, climbing those hills. Jeff, you've climbed those hills. They're steep, aren't they?
They're quite steep, John, to say the least, and steeper back then than they are now, as there's been modifications to the terrain since the park was created. But the real hero in all this, I think, along with Chamberlain, is perhaps his brigade commander, a guy named Strong Vincent, who's a lawyer from Erie, Pennsylvania, in command of three regiments. He was ordered to move his unit into the peach orchard to reinforce Sickles and basically reinforce failure. But he encounters a messenger who's got a message from Gouverneur Warren, the Union Army's engineer, requesting that troops be put on Little Round Top, because there's nobody up there. And so Vincent realizes suddenly the importance of Little Round Top and disobeys his orders and sends his brigade, including Joshua Chamberlain's regiment, up on Little Round Top. Otherwise, it's very possible the Confederates would have swept over Little Round Top and outflanked the Union position.
We have a minute here, Jeff. So the second day ends without resolution. They have not, the Lee's divisions have not broken the Union line. There's been a great deal of bloodletting. The evacuation from the battlefield is underway. Night falls, and Jeb Stuart shows up and reports to General Lee. Who is Jeb Stuart, and what is their exchange? We have less than a minute.
Well, Stuart is his principal cavalry commander. He had gone off on a large raid and had failed to do what Lee told him to do, which was maintain connection with the Army, because he had to provide information, intelligence. So Lee has been traveling blind. He is also a mentee in many ways of Lee's, as they go back many years, even to when Stuart was a cadet at West Point. So this is a very difficult meeting for Stuart when he meets General Lee, because Lee basically says to him, "You have let us down. We have been traveling blind," and some say, Jesse went so far as to say, "Only through the grace of God have we not been defeated due to your absence."
Colonel Jeb Stuart is the cavalry, and he's returned, but late. Lee needs information. When we come back, the third day and the decisions Lee makes, the Battle of Gettysburg, July 1st, 2nd, and 3rd, 1863, to determine the future of the country. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.